approached slowly, past the tent, and faded away. "Fat man with a dog," he said. "Gone now."
"Is she out of sight?"
"Yes, she's vanished. To Ramsgate, with any luck. May I come out?" He unlaced the flap and held it open.
"Oh, thank you," she said.
"May I pay you for the use of your tent?" His eyes opened wide. For a moment she thought he was going to laugh, but he politely declined. She felt herself beginning to blush. She should not have offered money. She turned away swiftly. "Don't go," he said. "I don't even know your name." "That payment I will exact."
"Sally Lockhart," she said, staring out to sea.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to insult you, but..."
"I'm not insulted at all, but you can't expect to pay for everything, you know. What are you going to do now?"
She felt very like a child. It was not a sensation she liked.
"I'm going back to London," she said. "I expect I shall manage to avoid her. Goodbye."
"Would you like a companion? I've nearly finished here, in any case, and if that old weasel is dangerous..."
"No, thank you. I must be going."
She walked away. She would have loved his company, but she would never have admitted it. She felt somehow that the pretense of helplessness, which worked so well with other men, would not take him in for a moment. That was why she had offered to pay him. She wanted to meet him on equal terms. But that had gone wrong, too. She felt as if she knew nothing, and could do nothing correctly. And she felt very alone. The Mutiny. There was no sign of the old woman at the station. The only other passengers were a parson and his wife, three or four soldiers, and a mother with two children. Sally found an empty compartment without difficulty. She waited until the train was steaming out of the station before she opened the parcel. The knots were carefully buried in sealing wax, and she broke a fingernail trying to scrape it away. Finally, she had it open, and discovered a book. It looked like a diary of some sort. It was quite thick, and the pages were covered in close writing. It had been roughly bound in grey cardboard, but the stitching was loose, and one whole section fell out in her hand. She replaced it carefully and began to read. The first page bore the inscription, "A narrative of the events in Lucknow and Agrapur, 1856-7, with an account of the disappearance of the Ruby of Agrapur and the part played by the child known as Sally Lockhart." She stopped and read it again. Herself. And a ruby. 100 questions rose suddenly like flies disturbed at a feast, and filled her head with confusion. She closed her eyes and waited for calm, then opened them and read on. "In 1856, I, George Arthur Marchbanks, was serving with the Duke of Cornwall's light infantry, the 32nd Foot, at Agrapur in Oude. Some months before the outbreak of the mutiny, I had occasion to visit the Maharaja of Agrapur in company with three of my brother officers, namely Colonel Brandon, Major Park, and Captain Lockhart. The visit was ostensibly a private one for the purpose of sport. In fact, however, our main purpose was to conduct certain secret political discussions with the Maharaja. The content of these discussions need not concern this account, except insofar as they contributed to the suspicion in which the Maharaja was held by a faction among his subjects, a suspicion which led, as I shall show, to his fate during the terrible events of the following year. On the second evening of our visit to Agrapur, the Maharaja gave a banquet in our honour. Whether or not it was his intention to impress us with his wealth, that was certainly the effect, for I had never set eyes upon so prodigal a display of splendour as that which met us that evening. The banqueting room was set about with pillars of marble, exquisitely carved, and bearing at their capitals representations of the lotus flower, lavishly covered in gold leaf. The floor we trod on was set with lapis lazuli and onyx. A fountain in the corner tinkled with rose-scented water, and the Maharaja's court musicians played their strange, languid melodies behind a screen of inlaid mahogany. The dishes were of solid gold, but the centerpiece of the display was the ruby, of incomparable size and lustre, which gleamed at the Maharaja's breast. This was the famous Ruby of Agrapur, about which I had heard a good deal. I could not help gazing at it. I confess that something in its depth and beauty, in the blood-red liquid fire that seemed to fill it, fascinated me and held my attention, so that I stared more than was strictly polite. At all events, the Maharaja noticed my curiosity and told us the story of the stone. It had been discovered in Burma 6 centuries before, and had been given in tribute to Balban, king of Delhi, from whom it had descended to the princely house of Agrapur. Throughout the centuries it had been lost, stolen, sold, given in ransom countless times, and had always returned to its royal owners. It had been responsible for deaths too many to list, murders, suicides, executions, and once it had been the cause of a war in which the population of an entire province had been put to the sword. Less than 50 years before, it had been stolen by a French adventurer. He, poor wretch, thought to escape detection by swallowing it, but in vain. He was torn open while still alive, and the stone plucked warm from his belly. The Maharaja's eyes met mine as he recounted these tales.
"Would you care to examine it, Major?" he asked. "Hold it close to the light, and look inside. But take care that you do not fall."
He handed it to me, and I did as he suggested. As the lamplight fell on the stone, a strange phenomenon took place. The red glow at the heart of it seemed to swirl and part like smoke, to reveal a series of ledges and chasms, a fantastic landscape of gorges, peaks, and terrifying abysses whose depth was impossible to plumb. Only once have I read of such a landscape, and that was in a work on the delusions and horrors of opium addiction. The effect of this extraordinary sight was what the Maharaja had predicted. I swayed, suddenly struck by the most dizzying vertigo. Captain Lockhart caught my arm, and the Maharaja took back the stone, laughing, and the incident was passed off with a joke. Our visit ended shortly afterwards. I did not see the Maharaja again for a year or so, and then only in the course of the horrible event which forms the climax of this narrative, an event which has brought me more shame and unhappiness than I would have imagined possible. May God, if there is a God and not an infinity of mocking demons, grant me oblivion and forgetfulness, and may it come soon. The year which passed after I first saw the stone was a time of omens and portents, signs of the terrible storm which was about to break over us in the mutiny, and signs which, to a man, we failed to read. On the horrors and savagery of the mutiny itself, it is not my present concern to dwell. Others more eloquent than I have told the story of this time, with its deeds of heroism shining like beacons amid scenes of hideous carnage. It is enough to say that while hundreds did not survive, I did, and so did 3 others, in whose destiny the ruby continues to play a large and commanding part. I pass on now to a time during the siege of Lucknow, not long before its relief by Havelock and Outram. My regiment was garrisoned in the city, and Sally looked up. The train had drawn into a station. She saw a sign saying Chatham. She shut the book, her head filled with strange images. A golden banquet, hideous deaths, and a stone that intoxicated like opium. 3 others had survived, said the Major. Her father and herself, she thought at once. And the third. She opened the book again, only to shut it hastily as the carriage door opened and a man got in. He was jauntily dressed in a bright tweed suit with a gaudy pin in his cravat. He lifted his bowler hat to Sally before sitting down.
"Afternoon, miss," he said.
"Good afternoon." She looked away out of the opposite window. She did not want conversation, and there was something about this man's familiar smile she did not like. Girls of Sally's class did not travel alone. It looked odd, and invited the wrong kind of attention. The train steamed out of the station, and the man took out a packet of sandwiches and started to eat. He took no more notice of her.
She sat still, gazing out at the marshes, the city in the distance, and the masts of ships in the docks, and shipyards far off to the right. Time passed. Eventually the train drew in at London Bridge Station, under the dark, smoky canopy of glass, and the sound of the engine changed as the steam hissed and echoed among the calls of the porters and the clanging of the jolting carriages. Sally sat up and rubbed her eyes. She had fallen asleep. The door of the compartment was swinging open. The man had gone. And so had the book. He had stolen it and vanished. The Ceremony of the Smoke. She leapt up in alarm and sprang to the door. But the platform was crowded, and the only thing she remembered of the man were his tweed suit and bowler hat, and there were dozens of those. She turned back to the compartment. Her bag lay in the corner where she had sat. She bent to pick it up, and then noticed on the floor, under the edge of the seat, a few sheets of paper. The book had been loosely bound. They must have fallen out, and she had let them drop in her sleep. And the thief hadn't noticed them. Most of them were blank, but on one there were a few lines of writing, continued from a previous sheet. They said, "A place of darkness, under a knotted rope. Three red lights shine clearly on the spot when the moon pulls on the water. Take it. It is clearly yours by my gift, and by the laws of England. Antequam, haec, legis, mortuus, iro, utinam, ex animo, hominum, tam, celerita, memoria, mea, discedat." Sally, who had no Latin, folded the paper and put it in her bag, and then, sick with disappointment, set out for Mrs. Rees's. Meanwhile, in Wapping, a sinister little ceremony was taking place. Once a day, on Mrs. Holland's orders, Adelaide took up a bowl of soup to the gentleman on the second floor. Mrs. Holland had discovered Matthew Bedwell's craving very early, and never slow to take up an opportunity, found her venomous old curiosity powerfully aroused. For her guest had fragments of a very interesting story to tell. He was delirious, alternately sweating with pain and raving at the visions which crowded in from the dirty walls. Mrs. Holland listened patiently, supplied a little of the drug, listened again, and provided more opium in exchange for details about the things he said in his madness. Little by little, the story emerged, and Mrs. Holland realized that she was sitting on a fortune. Bedwell's tale concerned the affairs of Lockhart and Selby, shipping agents. Mrs. Holland's ears pricked up when they heard the name Lockhart. She had her own interest in that family, and the coincidence astonished her. But as the tale came out, she realized that this was a new angle altogether. The loss of the schooner Lavinia, the death of the owner, the firm's unusually high profits from their China trade, 101 things besides. Mrs. Holland, though not a superstitious woman, blessed the hand of Providence. As for Bedwell, he was too helpless to move. Mrs. Holland was not quite sure that she had extracted all the knowledge that lay fuming in his brain, which was why she kept him alive, if he could be said to be living. As soon as she decided that the back bedroom was needed for some other purpose, Death and Bedwell, who had missed each other in the South China Sea, could finally keep their rendezvous in the Thames. A convenient address, Hangman's Wharf. So now Adelaide, having ladled a quantity of warm, greasy soup into a bowl, clumsily hacked a slice of bread to go with it, and climbed the stairs to the back bedroom. There was silence inside. She hoped he was asleep. She unlocked the door and held her breath, loathing the stale, heavy air and the damp chill that struck her as she entered. The gentleman was lying on the mattress with a rough blanket up to his chest, but he was not asleep. His eyes followed her as she put down the bowl on a nearby chair. "Adelaide," he whispered.
"Yes, sir."
"What you got there?"
"Soup, sir. Mrs. Holland says you've got to eat it up, 'cause it'll do you good."
You got a pipe for me?
After the soup, sir.
She did not look at him. They both spoke in whispers. He raised himself on one elbow and then struggled painfully upright, and she stood back against the wall as if she had no substance at all, as if she were a shadow. Only her huge eyes seemed alive.
"Give us it here,"
he said. She took him the bowl and crumbled the bread into it for him, and then went to the far wall as he ate. But he had no appetite. After a couple of spoonfuls, he pushed it away.
"Don't want it,"
he said. "There's no goodness in it. Where's the pipe?"
"You got to eat it, sir, 'cause Mrs. Holland will kill me else,"
said Adelaide.
"Please."
"You eat it. You could do with a feed," he said.
"Come on, Adelaide, the pipe, girl."
Reluctantly, she opened the cupboard, which, with the chair and the bed, was the only furniture the room possessed, and took out a long, heavy pipe, jointed in three sections. He watched intently as she fitted it together, laid it on the bed beside him, and cut a small piece of brown gum from a lump in the cupboard.
"Lie down,"
she said.
"It sends you off quick now. You've got to lie down, else you'll fall."
He did as the little girl said, stretching out languorously on his side. The chilly grey light of the fading afternoon, struggling through the grime on the tiny window, gave the scene the sombre colour of a steel engraving. An insect crawled lethargically across the greasy pillow as Adelaide applied a lighted match to the lump of opium. She passed the drug, transfixed on a pin, to and fro across the flame, until it began to bubble and the fumes soaked outwards. Bedwell sucked at the mouthpiece, and Adelaide held the opium above the bowl, and the sweet, heady smoke was dragged into the pipe. When it had stopped smoking, she lit another match and repeated the process. She hated it. She hated what it did to him, because it made her think that under every human face there was the face of a staring, dribbling, helpless idiot. "More," he mumbled.
"There ain't no more,"
she whispered.
"Come on, Adelaide," he whined.
"More." "One more, then."
Again she struck a match. Again the opium bubbled and fumed. The smoke poured into the bowl like a river disappearing underground. Adelaide shook out the match and dropped it with its fellows on the floor. He breathed a long sigh. The fumes were thick in the room now, making her feel dizzy.
"Do you know, I haven't got the strength to get up and leave," he said.
"No, sir,"
she whispered. A strange thing happened to his voice when he was in the opium trance. It lost the rough sailor's edge and became refined and even gentle.
"I think about it, though, day and night. Oh, Adelaide, the seven blessings. No, no, you fiends, devils, leave me."
He was starting to rave. Adelaide sat as far away from him as she could. She dare not leave, for fear Mrs. Holland would ask her what the gentleman had said, and yet she feared to stay, for his words brought nightmares to her. The seven blessings. This phrase had come twice lately, and each time with terror. He stopped in mid-sentence. Suddenly his expression changed and became lucid and confiding.
"Lockhart," he said.
"I remember now. Adelaide, are you there?" "Yes, sir,"
she whispered.
"Try to remember something for me, will you?"
"Yes, sir."
"A man called Lockhart asked me to find his daughter, a girl called Sally. I've got a message for her, very important. Could you find her for me?"
"I don't know, sir."
"Well, London's a big place. Perhaps you couldn't."
"I could try, sir."
"Good girl." "Oh, dear God, what am I doing?"
he went on helplessly.
"Look at me. As weak as a baby. What might my brother say?"
"You got a brother, sir?"
The light had almost gone now. She looked like a mother by the bed of her sick child, seen through the distorting haze of opium. She reached across and mopped his face with a filthy sheet. And he seized her hand gratefully. "A fine man," he mumbled. "My twin. Identical. The same body, but his spirit's all light, Adelaide, while mine's corruption and darkness. He's a clergyman, Nicholas. The Reverend Nicholas Bedwell. Have you any brothers or sisters?"
"No, sir, I ain't got any."
"Your mother alive? Or your father?"
"I ain't got a mother. I got a father, though. He's a recruiting sergeant."
This was a lie. Adelaide's father had been anonymous even to her mother, who herself had vanished a fortnight after the birth. But Adelaide had invented a father, and formed him in the image of the most splendid and gallant man her stunted life had ever seen. One of these swaggering figures, jaunty little pillbox hat cocked, glass in hand, had once winked at her as he stood with his fellows outside a public house and laughed loudly at some coarse jest. She hadn't heard the jest. All she had retained was an image of male, heroic splendour, falling suddenly into her dark little life like a shaft of sunlight. That wink had begotten a father upon his own daughter. "Fine men," muttered Bedwell. "Fine body of men." His eyes closed.
"Go to sleep, sir,"
she whispered. "Don't tell her, Adelaide. Don't tell her about what I said. She's an evil woman."
"Yes, sir."
And then he began to rave again, and the room filled up with ghosts and Chinese demons and visions of torture and poisoned ecstasy, and abysses yawned sickeningly below. Adelaide sat in the darkness, holding his hand, and thought. Messages. Since the death of Mr. Higgs, life at the office had grown dull. The feud between the porter and Jim the office boy had petered out, the porter having run out of hiding places and Jim having run out of penny magazines. He had nothing better to do that afternoon, in fact, than to flick bits of paper with an India rubber band at the portrait of Queen Victoria over the fireplace of the porter's room. When Adelaide arrived and tapped on the glass, Jim took no notice at first. He was busy improving his aim. The old man opened the window and said, "Yes, what do you want?"
"Miss Lockhart,"
whispered Adelaide. Jim heard and looked up. "Miss Lockhart," said the porter. "You sure?" She nodded.
"What do you want her for?"
said Jim.
"Never you mind, you weevil," said the old man.
Jim flicked a scrap of paper at the porter's head and dodged the frail blow aimed at him in return.
"If you got a message for Miss Lockhart, I'll take it," he said. "Come out here a minute."
He took Adelaide to the foot of the stairs out of earshot of the porter.
"What's your name?"
he said.
"Adelaide." "What do you want Miss Lockhart for?" "I don't know." "Well, who sent you?" "A gentleman."
He bent closer to hear what she said, becoming conscious of the aroma of Holland's lodgings about her clothes and of dirty child about her. But he wasn't fussy, and he had remembered something important.
"Did you ever hear,"
he said,
"of something called the Seven Blessings?"
In the past fortnight he had asked that of all kinds of people, except Mr. Selby. And he had always got the same response. No, they hadn't. But she had. She was frightened. She seemed to shrink inside her cloak, and her eyes became darker than ever.
"What of it?"
she whispered.
"You have, ain't ya?"
She nodded.
"Well,
what is it?"
he went on.
"It's important." "I don't know." "Where'd you hear of it?"
She twisted her mouth and looked away.
Two clerks came out of their office at the top of the stairs and saw them. "Here," said one of them, "look at young Jim courting."
"How's your lady laugh, Jim?" called the other.
Jim looked up and released a jet of language that might have blistered a battleship. He was no respecter of clerks. They were a very low form of life.
"Cool, listen to that,"
said the first clerk as Jim paused for breath.
"Such eloquence." "It's a delivery as I admires most," said the other. "It's the inhuman passion as he puts into it."
"Inhuman's the word," said the first.
"Shut your bum, Skidmore, and give your face a chance," said Jim. "I ain't got time to waste listening to you." "Here," he said to Adelaide. "Come on outside."
To the rousing whistles and jeers of the two clerks, he took Adelaide's hand and dragged her roughly down the corridor into the street.
"Never mind them," he said. "Listen, you got to tell me about the seven blessings. There's a man died in here because of that."
He told her what had happened. She did not look up, but her eyes widened.
"I've got to look for Miss Lockhart, 'cause he said so," she said when he'd finished. "Only I mustn't tell Mrs. Holland, else she'll kill me."
"Well, tell me what he bloody said. Go on."
She did, haltingly, little by little, for she had nothing of Jim's fluency, and she was so unused to being listened to that she hardly knew how loud to speak. Jim had to prompt her to repeat much of it.
"Right," he said eventually. "I'll fetch Miss Lockhart, and you can talk to her, all right?"
"I can't,"
she said.
"I can't never get away except when Mrs. Holland sends me out. She'll kill me."
"Go, she won't bleed and kill you. You'll have to come out, else..."
"I can't,"
she said.
"She killed the last little girl she had. She took all her bones out. She told me."
"Well, how are you going to find Miss Lockhart, then?"
"I don't know." "Oh, blimey.
Well, look, I'll come through Wapping each night on my way home, and you meet me somewhere and tell me what's happened. Where can you meet me?"
She looked down, twisting her mouth, thinking.
"By the old stairs," she said.
"All right, by the old stairs, every night, 6:30.
I gotta go now," she said.
"Don't forget," he called. 6:30.
But Adelaide had vanished. 13, Fortune Buildings, Chandler's Row, Clerkenwell. Friday 25th, October, 1872. Miss S. Lockhart, 9, Peveril Square, Islington. "Dear Miss Lockhart, I beg to inform you that I have discovered something about the seven blessings. There is a gentleman called Mr. Bedwell at present situated at Holland's Lodgings, Hangman's Wharf, Wapping. He has been taking opium and talking about you. He has also said the seven blessings, but I do not know what it means. The landlady is Mrs. Holland. She is not to be trusted. If you come to the bandstand in the Clerkenwell Gardens tomorrow at 2:30, I can tell you more. I beg to remain your humble and obedient servant, J. Taylor Esquire, Jim." Thus Jim, after the best models of clerkly correspondence. He posted the letter on Friday, in the confident expectation, this was the 19th century after all, of its being delivered before the day was out, and of Sally's tomorrow being the same as his.
Holland's Lodgings, Hangman's Wharf, Wapping, 25th of October, 1872. Samuel Selby, Esquire, Lockhart and Selby, Cheapside, London. "Dear Mr. Selby, I have the honour to represent a gentleman who has certain information concerning your enterprises in the East. This gentleman wishes it known that he will be obliged to publish what he knows in the papers unless certain conditions is agreed to. As a sample of his knowledge, he has asked me to mention the schooner Lavinia and a sailor named R. Ling. hoping this proposal is agreeable to you, and this finds you, as it leaves me, yours truly, M. Holland, Mrs. P.S. An early reply would be appreciated by all.
Thus Mrs. Holland, on her return, empty-handed but not unsatisfied, from Swale Ness. Sally stood under the inadequate shelter of a nearly bare lime tree in Clerkenwell Gardens and waited for Jim. The rain had already soaked her cloak and hat and was now insinuating itself down her neck. In order to come out at all, she had had to disobey Mrs. Rees. She dreaded the reception that awaited her return. But she did not have long to wait. Presently Jim came running, even wetter than she was, and tugged her over to the empty bandstand that stood on a patch of soggy grass.
"Under here,"
he said, lifting a loose panel in the side of the little stage. He dived into the gloom like a ferret. She followed him more carefully through the tunnels of folding chairs, and arrived at a cave-like hollow where he was already lighting a stump of candle. She settled down opposite him. The floor was dusty but dry, and the rain drummed on the stage overhead as he set the candle carefully upright between them.
"Well," he said, "do you want to hear or not?"
"Of course I do." Jim repeated all that Adelaide had told him, but more crisply. He was good with words. The penny dreadful had taught him well.
"What do you think of that, then?"
he said when he came to the end.
"Jim, it must be right. Mrs. Holland. It's the woman Major Marchbanks told me about, yesterday, in Kent." She told him what had happened.
"A ruby,"
he said, awestruck.
"But I don't see how it ties in with the rest of it. I mean, Major Marchbanks had never heard of the Seven Blessings. And this bloke of Adelaide's never said nothing about a ruby. Maybe there's two mysteries and not one. Maybe there's no connection."
"But there is a connection," said Sally.
"Me. And Mrs. Holland."
There was a pause.
"I'll have to see him," said Sally.
"You can't, not while Mrs. Holland's got him. Oh, yeah, I forgot. He's got a brother who's a parson. His name's Nicholas. They're twins."
"The Reverend Nicholas Bedwell," said Sally.
"I wonder if we could find him. Perhaps he could get his brother out." "He's a slave to opium," said Jim. "And Adelaide says he's terrified of Chinamen. Whenever he sees a Chinaman in his visions, he screams."
They fell silent for a moment.
"Oh, I wish I hadn't lost that book," said Sally.
"You never lost it. She had it pinched."
"She did? But it was a man he got in at Chatham.
Why would anyone want to scruff the old book unless they knew what was in it? Of course it was her doing."
Sally blinked. Why hadn't she made this connection? But once he had said it, it was obvious.
"So she's got the book," she said.
"Jim, it's going to drive me mad. What on earth does she want it for?" "You ain't half slow," he said severely. "It's that ruby she wants. What's it say on that bit of paper he left behind?"
She showed him.
"There you are. Take it," he says. "He's hidden it somewhere away from her, and he's telling you where it is. And I'll tell you something and all. If she wants the ruby, she'll be back for this."
On the following evening, three people sat in the kitchen at Holland's lodgings, where a filthy iron range gave off a tropical glow. One of the three was Adelaide, and Adelaide didn't count. She sat in the corner, disregarded. Mrs. Holland sat at the table, turning the leaves of Major Marchbank's book, and the third person was a visitor, seated in the armchair by the range, alternately sipping a mug of tea and mopping his brow. He wore a bright check suit. There was a brown bowler hat at the back of his head, and a sparkling pin in his cravat. Patting her teeth into place, Mrs. Holland spoke.
"Nice job of work, Mr. Hopkins," she said. "Very neatly done."
"Dead easy," said the visitor, modestly.
"She fell asleep, see? All I had to do was lift it off her little lap. Very nice. How'd you like another job? Any time, Mrs. H. Always ready to oblige. There's a lawyer up in Oxton, name of Blythe. He done a piece of business for me last week, only it went wrong, 'cause he'd been careless. That's what I had to go to Kent for, to sort it out.
Oh,
said the man, with delicate interest.
You'd like this lawyer giving, ticking off, is that it? That's about the size of it, Mr. Hopkins.
Well, I think I could manage that,
he said, comfortably blowing on his tea.
That, curious, is it, that book?
Not to me, said Mrs. Holland. I know this story off by heart.
Oh?
Said Mr. Hopkins carefully.
But it'd be interesting to that young lady. I dare say that if she was to read this, it would be a first-rate disaster. All my plans would come to nothing.
Oh, really?
So, I think she'd better have an accident.
Silence. He shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
Well, he said at length, I ain't sure as I wants to know about that, Mrs. Holland. And I ain't sure you've got much choice, Mr. Hopkins, she said, flicking through the pages. Dear me, these pages is loose. I hope you didn't lose none of them.
I don't understand, Mrs. H. I ain't got much choice about what?
But she had stopped listening. Her ancient eyes had narrowed. She read the last page of the book, turned back, flicked through the rest, read it again, held the book up and shook it, and finally flung it down with a curse. Mr. Hopkins backed away nervously.
Well, what's the matter?
He said.
You bleeding, oily popinjay, you tailor's dummy, you gone and lost the most important page in the old bleeding book!
I thought you said it's how you knew it all by heart, Mum.
She thrust the book at him.
Read this, if you can. Read it!
A horny old finger jabbed at the last paragraph in the book. He read it aloud.
I have therefore withdrawn the ruby from the bank. It is the only chance I have left of redeeming myself and saving something from the wreck of my life. The will I made, under the directions of that woman, has been annulled. Her lawyer failed to foresee a way out of the contract I signed. I shall die intestate, but I mean you to have the stone. I have hidden it, and to make doubly sure, I shall conceal its whereabouts in a cipher. It is in...
There was no more. He stopped and looked at her.
Yes, Mr. Hopkins, she said, smiling. You see what you done?
He quailed.
It weren't in the book, Mum,
he said.
I swear it!
I said something about an accident, didn't I?
He gulped.
Well, like I say,
you'll manage a little accident for her. You'll do that, all right, Mr. Hopkins.
One look at the paper tomorrow and you'll do whatever I want.
What do you mean by that?
Wait and see,
she said.
You're going to get that piece of paper. She'll have it somewhere. And then you're going to finish her off.
Oh, I ain't, he said unhappily.
Oh, you are, Mr. Hopkins. You take my word for it.
The consequences of finance. It did not take Mr. Hopkins long to find the story in the newspaper. It seemed to leap out of the page at him, accompanied by alarm bells, police whistles, and the clink of handcuffs. Mysterious death of retired major. Housekeeper tells of man in check suit. A survivor of the mutiny. The Kent police were alerted this morning to the mysterious death of Major George Marchbanks of Foreland House, Swaleness. His body was discovered by his housekeeper, Mrs. Thorpe,
in the library of his isolated dwelling. He had apparently been shot. An empty pistol was found nearby. The major lived a retired life, and his housekeeper was his only servant. According to a statement made by Superintendent Hewitt of the Kent Constabulary, the police are anxious to trace a man in a check suit, with a bowler hat and a diamond pin. This man visited Major Marchbanks on the morning of his death, when it is believed that an altercation took place. Major Marchbanks was a widower with no surviving family. He served in India for many years. Mr. Hopkins was overcome with rage, and had to sit down and catch his breath.
"You old crab," he muttered. "You spider. You calculating old bitch. Oh."
But he was caught, and he knew it. If he failed to do as she wanted, Mrs. Holland would manufacture some cast-iron evidence that would send him to the gallows for a murder he didn't commit. He sighed heavily, and went at once to change his clothes for a new serge suit in dark blue, wondering what this game was that Mrs. Holland was playing. If murder was one of the stakes, what must the prize be worth? Mrs. Rees's maid, Ellen, hated Sally, and didn't know why. Spite and envy were at the bottom of it, and the whole bundle of feelings was so uncomfortable that when she was offered a justification for her antipathy, she seized it at once without examining it too closely. This justification was provided by Mr. Hopkins. Mrs. Holland had ferreted Sally's address out of the lawyer's clerk, and Mr. Hopkins's smoothness of manner did the rest. He represented himself to Ellen as a police detective, and told her that Sally was a thief who had stolen some letters, a matter of such delicacy, family very highly connected, the slightest breath of scandal, the noblest in the land, etc. All that, of course, means nothing, but it was the sort of thing that filled the pages of the magazines that Ellen read, and she lapped it up at once. Their conversation took place on the area steps. She was very soon persuaded that her duty to herself, her mistress, and her country lay in admitting Mr. Hopkins secretly to the house after everyone had gone to bed. Accordingly, towards midnight, she opened the kitchen door, and Mr. Hopkins, fortified by a quantity of brandy, found his way upstairs to the door of Sally's room. He had some experience at this game, though he preferred the clean, manly sport of picking pockets, and he made no noise at all. Signalling to the maid to go on up to bed and leave him to his task, he settled down to wait on the landing until he was certain that Sally was asleep. A silver flask kept watch with him. It had made two journeys to his lips and come back lighter before he judged it time to move. He turned the handle of her door and opened it no more than 18 inches. Beyond that, Ellen had told him, it squeaked. A gas lamp in the square outside gave sufficient light through the thin curtains for him to be able to see most of the room, and he stood quite still for 2 minutes, getting his bearings, being particularly careful about the floor. There was nothing worse than a loose edge of carpet or a hastily dropped article of clothing. The only sound in the room was Sally's quiet breathing. Occasionally, the rattle of a late cab came from the road outside, but nothing else was stirring. Then he moved. He knew where she kept her papers. Ellen had been very free with her information. Hopkins emptied Sally's bag on the carpet, finding it heavier than he expected, and then he found the pistol. He gaped for a moment, thinking he'd come to the wrong room. But there was Sally, sleeping only 4 feet away. He picked up the weapon and tested its balance.
"You little beauty," he said silently. "I'm having you."
It went into his pocket, together with every scrap of paper in sight. Then he stood and looked around. Should he check all the drawers? But they might be full of papers, and what would he do then? After all, of all the bloody stupid things to ask a man to steal, a piece of bloody paper took the bloody biscuit. Now, the pistol, that was worth having. But he wasn't going to kill Sally for it. He looked down at her. Pretty girl, he thought. Only a kid. Be a shame when Mrs. Holland catches up with her. But she can arrange her own accidents. I'm not playing that game. He He left as silently as he'd come, and not a soul heard him go. But he didn't go far. As he rounded a dark corner in the wilderness of streets behind Holborn, an arm encircled his neck, a foot swept his legs from under him, and a very heavy knee plummeted into his midriff. It was too sudden, and the knife that slid into his ribs was cold, very much too cold, and froze his heart at once. And all he had time to think was,
"Not the gutter. My new coat. The mud."
Hands ripped the new coat open and plunged into the pockets. A watch and chain, a silver flask, a gold sovereign, and some copper, a diamond pin in the cravat, a few scraps of paper, and what was this? A gun? A voice laughed lightly, and footsteps died away. And presently it rained. Little scraps of anguish still fluttered in Henry Hopkins's brain, but it was not long before they settled into baffled oblivion, as the blood that sustained them leaked away out of the hole in his breast, and his life mingled with the dirty water in the gutter, and then plunged into the sewers and the darkness.
"Ah," said Mrs. Rees at breakfast, "our dear guest has descended, and strangely early, for the toast has not yet come. Usually it is all but cold when you arrive, but there is bacon. Will you have bacon? And could you contrive to leave it on the plate, unlike the kidneys of yesterday? Though bacon rolls less well than kidneys, I dare say you could force it off the plate if—"
"Aunt Caroline, I have been robbed," said Sally.
The old woman looked at her with intense and savage surprise.
"I do not understand," she said.
"Someone has come into my bedroom and stolen something, many things."
"Did you hear that, Ellen?"
said Mrs. Rees to the maid who had just brought in the toast.
"Miss Lockhart claims to have been robbed in my house, and does she blame my servants? Do you blame my servants, miss?"
The question was addressed in such a furious tone that Sally nearly quailed.
"I don't know who to blame, but when I woke up I found my bag upset all over the floor and several things missing, and—"
Mrs. Rees had gone red. Sally had never seen anyone so angry. She thought the old woman had gone completely insane and took a step backwards in fright.
"See, Ellen, see! She repays our hospitality by pretending to be the victim of a robbery! Tell me, Ellen, was the house broken into? Are there shattered windows and footprints? Are any other rooms disturbed? Tell me, child! I will not wait a moment for an answer! Tell me at once!"
"No, ma'am,"
said the maid, in a pious whisper, looking everywhere but at Sally.
"I promise you, Mrs. Rees, everything's where it should be, ma'am."
"On your promise, at least, I may rely, Ellen. Then tell me, miss."
Turning back to Sally, her face now twisted like some tribal mask, pale eyes bulging and papery lips drawn up in a sneer,
"tell me why these robbers who did not enter the house should select you for their imaginary attentions. What did you have that anyone would want?"
"Some papers," said Sally, who was now shaking from head to foot. She could not understand it. Mrs. Rees seemed possessed.
"Some papers! Some papers! You wretched girl! Papers! Let me see the scene of the crime. Let me see it. No, Ellen, I can rise without assistance. I am not so old that all the world may take advantage of my weakness. Out of my way, girl, out of my way!"
This, in a shriek to Sally, who, confused, hovered between the table and the door. Ellen, solicitous, stood aside smartly, and Mrs. Rees tottered up the stairs. At the door of Sally's room she stopped, waiting for it to be opened, and again it was Ellen who was there to do it, Ellen who took her arm as she entered, Ellen who cast, for the first time, a look of sly triumph at Sally, who had followed. Mrs. Rees looked around, The bedclothes were piled untidily. Sally's nightgown trailed half across the floor and half over the end of the bed, and two of her drawers were open with clothes jammed hastily into them. The pathetic little heap of things beside Sally's bag on the floor, a purse, a coin or two, a handkerchief, a pocket diary, was scarcely noticeable. Sally saw that the case was hopeless before Mrs. Rees said a word.
"Well?"
was that word.
"Well, Miss..."
I must have been mistaken," said Sally.
"I beg your pardon, Aunt Caroline."
She spoke almost demurely because an idea had just come into her head. Something quite new. She stooped to pick up the things from the floor and found herself smiling.
"What are you grinning at, miss? Why are you smiling in that insolent fashion? I will not be smiled at."
Sally said nothing, but began to fold her clothes and put them neatly on the bed.
"What are you doing? Answer me! Answer me at once, you impertinent hussy!"
"I'm going to leave," said Sally.
"What? What did you say?"
"I'm going to leave, Mrs. Rees. I can't stay here any more. I can't, and I won't." A gasp from the lady, another from the maid, and they stood aside as Sally made purposefully for the door. "I shall send for my things," she said. "You will have the goodness to send them on when I let you know my new address. Good day." And she left. And found herself, once on the pavement outside, quite at a loss what to do next. She had burnt her boats, she was sure of that. She could never go back to Mrs. Rees, but where else could she go? She walked on steadily out of Peveril Square and past a newsagent's, which gave her an idea. With almost the last of her money, 3 pennies, she bought a copy of the Times and sat down to read it in a nearby churchyard. There was only one page which interested her, and it was not that which bore advertisements for governesses. Having penciled some notes in the margin of the paper, she walked briskly to Mr. Temple's chambers in Lincoln's Inn. It was a fine morning, after the incessant drizzle of the night before, and the sun lifted her spirits. Mr. Temple's clerk admitted her. The lawyer was very busy indeed, but he might be prevailed upon to see her for 5 minutes. She was shown into the office. Mr. Temple, bald and lean and brisk, got up to shake her hand. "How much money have I got, Mr. Temple?" she said, after they had exchanged greetings. He reached for a large book and wrote down some figures. £450 in 2.5% treasury stock, 180 ordinary shares in the London and South Eastern Railway Company, 200 preference shares in the Royal Mail Steam Navigation Company. Are you sure that you want to know all this?" "Everything, please." She was following it in the newspaper as he read. He continued. It was not a long list. "And the income," he concluded, "is, in round terms..." "About £40 a year," she said. "How did you know that?" "I worked it out as you were reading the list." "Good Lord. And I believe I have a measure of control over my money?" "A great deal, far too much in my view. I tried to dissuade your father, but nothing would make him change his mind, so I drew up the will as he told me." "Then it's a good thing you failed. Mr. Temple, I'd like you to arrange to sell £300 of the Treasury stock and buy equally among the following companies: the Great Western Railway Company, the Gas, Light and Coke Company, and C.H. Parsons Limited." His jaw fell, but he wrote down her instructions. "Furthermore," she said, "those preference shares in the Royal Mail Steam Navigation Company, sell those, please, and buy ordinary shares in the P&O. That should bring the income up to a little over 50. I shall look at it again in a month or so when I have time. I take it that there is some money paid on my account now to Mrs. Rees." "Mrs. Rees was paid," he turned the page, £100 on your father's death. That was a legacy, of course, not a payment for any service that might be rendered. The trustees, of whom I am one, came to an agreement by which the income from the trust should be paid on your behalf to Mrs. Rees while you remained under her roof."
"I see," said Sally.
That woman had been receiving all Sally's income, while accusing her of living on charity. "Well," she went on, "I have been discussing things with Mrs. Rees, and it will be best if the income is paid directly to me from now on. Could you arrange for it to be paid into my account at the Strand branch of the London and Midland Bank?" Mr. Temple looked decidedly troubled. He sighed and wrote it down, but said nothing. "And finally, Mr. Temple, may I have some money now? You didn't mention a current account, but there must be one." He turned a page in her ledger. "It contains £21.06.09, he said. "How much would you like to withdraw?"
£20, please.
He opened a cash box and counted out the money in gold.
"Miss Lockhart, I ask you simply, is this wise?
It is what I want to do, and I have the right to do it, so it will be done. One day, Mr. Temple, I promise I'll tell you why. Oh, there is another thing." He pushed the cash box away and faced her.
"Yes?"
"Did my father ever mention a Major Marchbanks?"
"I have heard the name. I don't think your father had seen him for many years. A friend from his army days, I believe."
"Or a Mrs. Holland?" He shook his head. "Or anything at all called the Seven Blessings?"
"What an extraordinary name. No, Miss Lockhart, he didn't."
"And I won't take up any more of your time, Mr. Temple. But what about my father's share of his own firm? I had expected that to be worth something." He stroked his jaw and looked ill at ease.
"Miss Lockhart, you and I will have to have a talk. Not now, I'm busy, but it'll keep for a week or so. Your father was a very unusual man, and you're a very unusual young lady, if I may say so. You're conducting yourself in a most businesslike way. I'm impressed. So I'll tell you something now that was going to keep till you were a little older. I'm worried about that firm, and I'm worried about what your father did before he left for the East. You're quite right, there should be more money. But the fact is that he sold his share outright for £10,000 to his partner, Mr. Selby."
"And where is that money now?"
"That's what I'm worried about. It's vanished."
The Passions of Art. There were few places in the England of 1872 where a young lady could go on her own to sit and think, and possibly drink some tea. The tea was not so important yet, but sooner or later she would have to eat, and there was only one class of well-dressed young women who moved freely in and out of hotels and restaurants, and Sally had no desire to be mistaken for one of those. But she was, as Mr. Temple had said, a very unusual young lady. Her upbringing had given her an independence of mind that made her more like a girl of today than one of her own time, which was why she had walked out, and why she was not daunted by the prospect of being alone. She left Lincoln's Inn, and walked slowly along beside the river, until she found a bench under the statue of some bewigged king, and then she sat down to watch the traffic. The biggest blow was the loss of her pistol. She had copied the three lost papers, the message from the East, Major Marchbanks's letter, and the single page from the book, into her diary, so they were preserved. But the pistol had been a gift from her father, and besides, it might one day save her life. But what she wanted most was to talk. Jim Taylor would have been the ideal person to talk to, but it was Tuesday, and he would be working. Then there was Major Marchbanks, but Mrs. Holland might be watching the house, as she had before. Then she remembered the card tucked into her diary. Thank heaven the thief had not removed that. Frederick Garland, photographic artist, 45, Burton Street, London. She had some money now. She hailed a cab and gave the driver the address. Burton Street was a shabby little place in the neighbourhood of the British Museum. The door of number 45 was open. A painted sign proclaimed that W. and F. Garland, photographers, conducted their business there. Sally went in and found a dusty, narrow little shop crowded with various photographic bits and pieces, magic lanterns, bottles of chemicals, cameras and the like, standing on the counter and packed untidily on the shelves. There was no one there, but the inner door was open, and Sally could hear voices raised in a violent quarrel. One of them was the photographer's.
"I will not!" he shouted.
I detest all lawyers on principle, and that goes for their spotty clerks as well.
I'm not talking about lawyers, you lazy oaf,
came the equally passionate voice of a